Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming on tonight on this cold Sydney night. Valerie Lawson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was here in the 1990s talking about a book on the Ellen's Affair. But she's back on this occasion for the paperback edition of Mary Poppins she wrote. I'll introduce our speaker briefly. Valerie Lawson is an author, a freelance journalist, and she's the Nancy Keesing Fellow at the State Library of New South Wales in 2010. Her published books are Connie Sweetheart, The Ellen's Affair, and Mary Poppins. She wrote the biography of P.L. Travers, which was first published in 1999 under a different title and has been republished in Britain, in the United States, and now in Australia. Valerie Lawson, of course, was a journalist at Fairfax Media for many years as a writer and as an editor. She was the foundation editor of Good Weekend, the editor of The Times on Sunday, and the arts editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, and won a number of awards, including a Walkley Award in 1998. But she's here back at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of the latest edition of Mary Poppins. She wrote the true story of Australian writer P.L. Travers, creator of the quintessentially English nanny. Valerie Lawson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gerard. I think many of you probably have seen or watched The Gruen Transfer, which is the ABC TV program which reveals the secret and hidden persuasive ways of the advertising industry. And every week they have a segment where two advertising agencies come along and have to create a 30-second ad to sell the unsellable, virtually, something that's really odd or mysterious or just a big challenge. For example, they might have to promote saving a species, not a nice cuddly species like panda bears, but maybe a porcupine or warthogs. I think it would be very interesting if they ever had to try and sell Pamela Travers, because she was a very secretive person. She didn't tell anybody anything. It would be a great challenge for the Gruen Transfer advertising agencies to try and sell her. Sometimes she even claimed that she wanted to be called Anon, Anon for Anonymous. So in direct contrast to that, though, she created a character, Mary Poppins, that was almost like a slogan, and, you know, a brand, isn't she? Like, people say, oh, I can't cope with the children, I can't do anything, and then you think to yourself, call for Mary Poppins. Or the stock market's falling again, as it is at the moment. What do? Call for Mary Poppins. She's a kind of person that can solve everything. And even this week, the financial commentator Alan Kohler compared the Prime Minister to Mary Poppins when he wrote, Julia Gillard really is the Prime Minister who gets things done. The Mary Poppins of tax policy. So you can agree with that or not, and I don't particularly agree with that, but you can see how Mary Poppins is everywhere. One centre of Poppins as a product is Maryborough, the Queensland city in which she was born. And this week, to celebrate the 11th annual Mary Poppins Week, the local paper, the Fraser Post Chronicle, reported the Mary Poppins brand is in global demand right now. The report goes on to mention the Mary Poppins stage musical, which is about to open in Melbourne, and the plans for Barrel to have its own Mary Poppins celebration, because Pamela lived there as a teenager. The mayor of Maryborough said there was enough of Mary Poppins to be shared with everyone. The local council of Maryborough is promising a new Mary Poppins products and experiences, including murals and a magical Mary interactive tour, which I think might be. I'm not quite sure what it'll be like, but maybe one day I'll experience it. Well, Pamela lived in four places before she left Australia forever in 1924. The Sydney suburb of Ashfield, Maryborough, Ellerow, which is a small town in Queensland, and also Bowral. But apart from that, I mean, they all have Mary Poppins statues now, except for Barrow, which is, you know, commissioning one. So each small community has kind of adopted or taken Mary Poppins as kind of branding of their own community. But apart from those centres, hardly anybody knows, you know, who Pamela Travers was. Even Cameron McIntosh, who's producing a musical, said to me a few months ago, well, despite your book, nobody knows that, you know, Mary Pamela Travers was Australian, which I thought was not a very tactful thing to say to me. So when I've been interviewed over this on this book for many years, people have asked me two particular questions. One is, why is so little known about this woman? And why does nobody know that she was Australian? But I think the first reason was her name. I mean, Pamela Travers was totally manufactured. It wasn't her real name at all. Her real name was Helen Lyndon Goff. And the family called her Lyndon, which was the name she shared with the President of the United States, LBJ, with whom she had nothing in common at all. But she became known as Pamela Travers, and then P.L. Travers, and finally Dr. Travers. And Pamela Travers came about because early in her life, when she was about 18, she became a dancer and an actress. And in those days, the late teens, early 20s, women were not usually known by their real name. They often assumed a pseudonym for the stage. And so she became Pamela because if you look at those sort of fashion baby names over the decades, you'll find that Pamela was quite a fashionable name in the 20s. So she took the name Pamela, and then she took the name Travers, because Travers was the Christian name of her father. He was Travers Goff, and she loved, desperately loved her father. He died when she was very young, so she became Pamela Travers. And then, when she became an author, she became P.L. Travers. So she kind of hid behind initials, which wasn't so unusual for her time, because at that time, especially when she went to live in England, her world was populated by initial people. You know, it was T.S. Eliot, G.B. Shaw, W.B. Yeats, C.S. Lewis. She also liked to quote Ian Forster. And she became very friendly with a man called George William Russell, who went by the initials A.E. So their initials were fashionable at that time. So that was the P.L. Travers part. But she also liked P.L. Travers because it related to J.M. Barrie and A.A. Milne, both children's writers, and they were both men. So P.L. could have been a man's name and a man's initials, and she did not want to be known as particularly a woman or a man, so she assumed, you know, initials which could be quite ambiguous. Incidentally, she also used to say that she liked to be known as a writer for adults, not for children, because she thought that was more superior to be a writer for adults. So here she is hiding behind these two things, the pseudonym and, you know, the initials. But I think, you know, that wasn't the only reason that, you know, she was so... They were just one mask. Behind that, there was another disguise. And that was, she was like Mary Poppins herself. She didn't want to tell anybody anything. She liked to invent her past. For example, she claimed to be the daughter of a sugar plantation owner in Queensland. She wasn't. And even in her obituary in the New York Times and the Times of London, she said she was the daughter of an Irish sugar plantation manager. You know, I don't know where she got this idea. She liked to create fantasy wherever she went and whatever she said. She once told a group of students in America, "You're trying to find out my secrets. A secret is something that must not be told." Like, she was very stern in that way. She said, "I don't wear my private life on my sleeve." And she also said, later in her life, something quite poignant, I think, that I've had a lot of suffering in my life, but I only share my suffering with my pillow, which I think is quite, it's very sad. But in other words, don't ask me any questions. So I think the secrecy was to do partly with the times. You know, she grew up in a time where you didn't share your private life, private thoughts with anybody, because it's slightly vulgar. Not like today, where on social media you tell everybody anything that seems, but... There was something more than that about Pamela. She had a kind of shame about her life. And the shame was in many ways, but one of the shames was that she was the daughter of an alcoholic. So her father was the manager of a bank in Maryborough. He was demoted to Ellera, which is a small town near Toowoomba, because he was an alcoholic. And then he died of alcoholism, a alcohol-related disease. So she was only seven, and she tried to hide this all her life. You know, she was the daughter of an alcoholic. And then, really sadly, she, through a chain of circumstances, she became the mother of an adopted son who was an alcoholic. So it really was dreadful for her. This whole thing, another thing that had happened to her is that her mother, after she became a widow, was so distressed by the family's distraught sort of circumstances, they had no money by then, that she decided to throw herself in the river in Barrel. It was a flood on that particular winter night, but she said to her three daughters, she had three girls then, Pamela was the oldest, I'm going to kill myself. And then she ran outside and said, I'm going to throw myself in the river, not coming back. And Pamela, who was 10, had to kind of console the other daughters, the other sisters. So there was also that, of course, the mother did come back, but, you know, father, alcoholic son, mother that tried to commit suicide. These things were quite shameful. Now you would probably go on some program, TV program, and tell the world about it, you know. But then, so the chain of events that led to the adoption of the son came about because after an exciting career in Sydney as an actor, a dancer and a writer, journalist and poet, Pamela went to London alone in 1934 with £10 in her pocket, she claimed, and she sent some poems to one of her heroes, George William Russell, the editor of the Irish Statesman. It's a very well-known publication in Dublin at the time. And he said, oh, no, please read my poems, please. And he wrote back, if you're ever in Dublin, please come and see me. So, of course, Pamela was on the next ferry from London to West Coast to Dublin. Yes. And he almost adopted her. There was a kind of father-daughter relationship, but also I think he could have been a lover, but, you know, the letters are very intimate that I've read between them, but, you know, there's no knowing. And he introduced her in turn to people like George Bernard Shaw and Yeats, Lady Gregory, and Oliver St. John Gogarty, and all the Irish circle at the time. It's very exciting for Pamela. And also he introduced her to Francis McNamara, who became her lover, and she really loved this man. McNamara was a writer and a poet, but he was, you know, a flirt and a Don Juan, and he just had so many women in his life, and he just broke her heart. So in the 1930s, the late 1930s, she decided she wanted to adopt a child. And she didn't particularly want to be married, but she really wanted a child, something of her own. And so she lived in Mayfield, Sussex at the time. Mayfield's a little township, little village in East Sussex, where she wrote her first Mary Poppins book in the 1930s. And the maid there, the maid and cleaner, came at 9 o'clock every morning after 3, was a woman called Doris. And Doris had never been away from Mayfield in her life, except she told me once to go to Harrods. She went to London to Harrods and she didn't like it. But Doris and I met in 1997 in Mayfield, and I interviewed her. And she tells about that. And can you, I've still got the tape recording on old cassette of my conversation with Doris. So, Anne, could you?
Tell me, you know, she wanted to adopt you. Tell me about that. That's amazing.
Well, I don't know, I can't tell you much about this. She got in her head, she wanted to adopt somebody. So she wanted to adopt me, because Mum had got seven of us.
That was amazing, girls. She adopted one of seven children.
Yeah, she did. And that's why she had the bedrooms to put on. That little bedroom there.
Which one?
This one? Yeah.
Just between the study and the main.
Between the study and the main name. She had that put on. She had it in her head that she was going to adopt me. Of course, Mum and Dad were aware of it. And then the next thing I heard, she adopted Crawley.
Did you ever talk to her about it?
I told her I didn't want to go. Didn't want to come down here. I was happy, Mum. We was happy.
Did she talk to you about what she take me happy?
Oh, she said she'd take me to see the world. Well, I didn't want to. She got the thing in her bonnet, she wanted to adopt me. As I say, Mum had got 7 of us, you know.
She went up to see your mother?
Yeah. And I said, no, certainly not.
What year would that be, do you think? That you've been here a long time.
Oh, gosh. Well, it was only 3.5 years working for me. It was doing that song. I can't remember if it was. I think it was when I first came out.
That's Dorothy. I hope Doris is still alive. She's a lovely lady. She really is. She married eventually. As well as Doris. But when Doris and her parents turned Pamela down, Pamela thought, I still want a child, so she went to Dublin and adopted a boy whose name was Camillus, and he was one of seven grandchildren of one of Yeats's biographers, Joseph Hone, H-O-N-E. The circumstances of that were really extraordinary. It was just before the Second World War. She went to Dublin, and all her children were for adoption of Joseph Hone's son, who himself was an alcoholic. And she saw these twin boys on two single beds side by side. One was called Camillus and one was called Anthony. Anthony was gurgling, you know, little baby gurgling, happy. Camillus was crying. And she said, I'll take Camillus. I'll take the crying baby, which in itself was really, really peculiar, I think. So she took him back to London, to Mayfield in Sussex, and looked after him. And I can't imagine why this family put their children out for adoption, but, you know, the father being an alcoholic, I think they just couldn't handle it at the time. The extraordinary thing is that she never told Camillus, it's a funny name, isn't it? Camillus, it's like a Latin name, that he was adopted. And so he found out when he was about 17 or 18 in London, in Chelsea, where they lived, when his twin turned up in a pub. Now, there's two stories about this. He either turned up in a pub, and they met in a pub in Chelsea, or he knocked on the door and said, I know I'm a twin, and I think that you're my twin brother. This was so traumatic for Camillus that he turned to the bottle. He became a really serious alcoholic. I mean, it was so bad, and it still was, I'm not sure if it still was, but it was when I met him, that he was, you know, forced down the street, you know, he's taken into prison for drink driving, serious hurting somebody, and also he's been drying out in various hospitals over the years. So this was a matter of great shame, obviously, for Pamela, and shame is a very powerful human emotion that we have. I mean, we talk about all sorts of other things, but, you know, people don't talk about shame, and I think that's a real reason that Pamela felt so incredibly, you know, secretive about her life. Another reason was that she had some ambiguous and probably maybe lesbian relationships with like two other women, one of whom was called Madge Bernand, who was the daughter of the editor of Punch magazine. And they lived together for a while in Mayfield in Sussex. So all this added up to a sort of big amount of shame. So it's no wonder, I think, that in her will she added an addendum, a letter to her trustees in 19, she signed it just before she died, in early February 1996, I should say. And she wrote, although I have no objection to anyone writing about my work, I don't want any personal material recorded. Therefore, I don't wish any biography of myself to be written, and nor are my letters to be published at any time. And, of course, no one can control what happens after they die, much as we might like to. A will is one thing. You can abide by the terms of the will. The solicitors have to, the trustees have to. You can write a letter saying, please don't do this, please don't do that. But it doesn't matter. People can do anything. And of course I had some guilt about writing the biography myself, but 3 months after my biography came out, all her friends, or many of her friends, who said, we won't talk to you about it all, they wrote their own book all about Pamela. So my guilt was lessened. This week I read yesterday that biography of Martin Amis is maybe scrapped, and the author has to send back his advance and end his contract because Martin Amis had the rights to vet the text, which I think is a crazy thing for a publisher to do, but to allow that contract to be written. But I mean, that's a whole other subject, isn't it? Biography and what one can do and what one can't do. I'm sure that J.D. Salinger's biography is going to be written very soon, and he never wanted anyone to do it. So the thing about Pamela, though, the ambiguity, was that she put all of her papers, or most of her papers, she sold them to the State Library of New South Wales, so she didn't want anything known. Why did she do that? So, you know, there were 28 boxes in the State Library just over the road, which I was able to go through. And also her son, who has moments of clarity and not, gave me access to all her papers in her old home in Chelsea. So I was able to go through them as well, of course. So just moving briefly on to hiding the fact that she was an Australian, I mean, there were two reasons for that. One, is geographical. She lived here in the 20s. She never came back except once in the 1960s when she said, she told an interviewer, "I don't mean to denigrate Australia in any way. When I made the trip, we landed in Perth," that would have been by plane, "at night. And I stood outside and I saw the stars, stars I hadn't seen for all those years. I thought to myself, well, if fate puts me down here, I can bear it." You know, bear it. It looks like a really bad case of cultural cringe. You know, like, why would she sort of reject her Australian identity? She called herself a citizen of the British Empire or the British Commonwealth. She adopted a very plummy voice, which you're going to hear in a minute. I've got another tape of her speaking. But I think that it's not so unusual in those times that young Australian women wanted to go to England. They wanted to escape Australia. They wanted to find themselves. They wanted to go home, you know, capital H, home. Mum and Dad talked of home. They could find themselves in England. That was their identity, you know. It's like, that's, everybody wanted to go home. And she did too. And also her father claimed to be Irish. He wasn't, he was English, but she thought she must go back to the home of her father, to where all those wonderful poets were, like Yeats. And Travers really was an Australian woman of her times who genuinely believed that she belonged in Britain, that Maryborough and Barrow and Sydney, they were all foreign places. She really belonged, you know, in Britain. First half of the century, despite the fact that they sniffed their nose at us, they said we were colonials, and that for me made it even more delightful that eventually she created the quintessential English nanny, you know, perfectly British in every way. So the other question that's often asked of me and often asked of Pamela is, how did she create Mary Poppins? Why did she create? Well, she used to wave her hands about and say, "Oh, I don't know, she just drifted into my life, you know, somewhere along the way, I can't really say." But the fact was that Mary Poppins came from Pamela's own life. When the family that she grew up with was quite wealthy, they had a maid called Bertha who had a parrot-headed umbrella. It's like Mary Poppins, so she would go up and she would never say where she was going, just like Mary Poppins. And Bertha would come back and say, "Don't ask me where I was, I won't tell you." She also had a great aunt called Helen Moorhead, who was very well connected with the Knox family of Willara. She lived in Willara. She knew all those people, the Fairfaxes, the ladies of Askin, and this woman supported the family. This great aunt had sayings like "spit spot into bed," and everything that Mary Poppins said. So, in fact, Helen Moorhead was a prototype for Mary Poppins. And Pamela said that she stalked with her silent feet through the pages of Poppins. And there's no doubt also in my mind that Mary Poppins has been influenced by Pamela's father. In the books there's Mr. Banks. You know Mr. Banks was the father? Well, he is actually Pamela's father. When Pamela was a little girl, they used to stare at the night sky in Barbara, and they would dream about, you know, floating up to the stars. And I think, you know, Mr. Banks definitely, you know, was based on that father. When he died, when the real father died, Pamela used to imagine him as a star. And so you'll find, if you go back to Mary Poppins books, if you have children or grandchildren, you'll find stars everywhere in the Mary Poppins books. So Mary Poppins is a product. She's had many lives. Subject of 8 books between 1934 and 1988, an incredibly long time. But when Walt Disney made his movie of Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke, that's when she really became famous. Pamela was very ambiguous about the movie. She claimed, she didn't say much about it in the beginning, but eventually she said she hated it. It was totally Disney. It was all fantasy and no magic. It had nothing of the true essence of her books. And it was as far from magic that she said. She was as far from magic as it was possible to be. At the time the movie was released, she agreed to merchandise. There were Mary Poppins stockings and Mary Poppins chocolates and so on. But eventually she became much more controlling about Mary Poppins merchandise. And in that addendum to the will that I mentioned before, she also said that when Samuel Goldwyn Jr. wanted to create a TV series on Mary Poppins, and every week there'd be a new Mary Poppins adventure that she hadn't written. You know, Pamela herself hadn't written. She said, I can't agree to that at any time. So the irony is, of course, that Pamela herself needed comfort. She needed a nanny herself. She was a woman that was quite disturbed and sad. She lived by a phrase borrowed by from the novelist Ian Forster, only connect. And she spent her long life searching for connections, looking for love, seeking comfort from gurus, doctors and mystics. In old age she became a mystic and a guru herself, but she never really recovered from the death of her father, I don't believe. So it's not surprising she created a fictional nanny that could make connections between disconnected people. Mary Poppins flies down from the heavens to connect parents to their children and leaves when she's made a very unhappy family happy again. I feel sorry myself that she suffered so much in her life. And despite all of Pamela's gruffness, I feel kind of an admiration for one who should have fashioned her own life, really. She left Australia so young, alone. She never found a lifelong partner. She went to the Soviet Union as a young woman, alone, extraordinarily in the 30s. She went and spent 2 summers in New Mexico with the Navajo people. Amazing things that, you know, were so brave at the time, but she found her sort of solace in following a mystic, a man called George Ivanovich Gurdjieff. I don't know if you've ever heard of Gurdjieff. Very strange man who's mainly known by the people that he taught. And it's Catherine Mansfield, Frank Lloyd Wright, T.S. Eliot, Timothy Leary, and even Kate Bush. And Lincoln Kirstein, who was the financial supporter of George Balanchine, the choreographer, all followed the way of George Gurdjieff. Some people say he was a charlatan, a crook. Other people say that he had the most wonderful idea and saved people, even though Catherine Mansfield died in one of his retreats in near France. She died, she bled to death. Gurdjieff was there that day. It's shocking, but Pamela followed in Gurdjieff's way. And she eventually hosted a little Gurdjieff group to her own home, which used to drive her son crazy because they all seemed crazy, you know, weird people, little church groups, you know, people have a number of different ears and nose, you know, weird, listening to Pamela talking. And I've got a tape of Pamela talking, just play it very briefly, and you'll see the accent. She talks a lot.
In a thoughts. I'm here, condition. And I had noted down here something that I would think about a great deal of it. You can't help thinking about it in this world where everybody is demanding their rights. Human rights. I never heard Mr. Bitter talk about rights. But that led me to search in all the traditions that I have, very lightly and as an amateur study. Not one of them speaks about right. Am I right? Am I correct? We have no rights. We have no rights. As I see it, this is me, I'm not being wrong. But they all speak about a purpose to be served. And I feel if that were served, and this is just my own pondering, if that were served, rights would fall into their place. We wouldn't have to worry about rights. Especially think about this idea of women's rights. I have a jolly good laugh sometimes in my cozy bed thinking, you don't really know, you've got all the rights in the world. And you don't have to get up and be prime minister or a priest or anything like that. No. You are a prime minister, you are a priest, you pay the world, you bear life. And you're worrying about when do I get to be Lord Mayor?
She was 18, and that's why her voice is fluctuating and quite hard to hear. She's talking about, you know, why women's rights, you know, why should women demand rights? Why should they want to be prime minister? She was very old at that time. Well, finally, I just want to mention the last stage of reincarnation of Pamela Travis. It's a stage show that's happening in Melbourne in 2 weeks' time. It started in 1995 when Sir Cameron McIntosh called on Pamela, very old lady at the time, and he persuaded her, being the great charmer that he was, that she should sell him the stage rights to her Mary Poppins. And he said, look, I'm not going to do it unless you let me use some of the Disney songs, like annoyingly, you know, songs that are in our minds forever, like Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. And she agreed. So, you know, eventually he got the help of Disney Theatrical to, you know, cooperate. So it's a joint production between Cameron McIntosh and Disney. It opened in 2004 in the West End in London, moved to New York. It's been on 4 years in New York. It's playing in Amsterdam. It's coming to Melbourne, and it's now going to, after that, Sweden, Denmark, Czech Republic, Hungary, Israel, Spain, Italy, Mexico, Korea, Canada, and Japan. So late last month, it grossed more than $400 million worldwide. So, you know, talk about a brand, a product. Mary Poppins is now gone global, totally. I think it's a great result for her son and for their grandchildren because they get royalty from every performance. So I don't think the Pamela Pantechnicon, as I call it, has actually ended. I think it's still on its journey, and there's at least one plan for production, movie production, joint Australian-English production. And if it goes ahead, I think it would be great if they got Helen Mirren to play Pamela Travers. If that happened, she'd be famous forever. Pamela would secretly say, I hate it, I don't want it, I don't want it, she'd say. Secretly, she'd love it.
Many thanks. So Janet Grundy's got some copies of Mary Poppins she wrote, and I'm sure our author would be happy to sign them. So we come to question and discussion. Andrew.
Was she the J.K. Rowling of her day?
Yes.
And the second question is, what triggered this question of yours to make this Aussie now this obscure?
Just repeat the question.
Well, was she the J.K. Rowling of the day? Yes, she was. J.K. Rowling, of course, is one children's author that has got the initials. Mm. Not many do, but, you know, she's written this period story of Harry Potter. It's exactly the same thing, really. But she wasn't as well known as J.K. Rowling. I mean, Harry Potter sold trillions, hasn't it, really? Mary Poppins sold modestly in the beginning. I was the editor of Good Weekend when I heard about Trevor's Australian identity. And I've been a journalist for many years, and I love a mystery. I love unravelling a story. And I thought, okay, this is a very strange, interesting story. And I just wanted to unravel all the layers, go through it, find out. It became more and more compelling to actually find out who she was and why she hid herself like this.
We played that segment there. She's got a, as you pointed out, she's got a kind of contrived accent, but did the British know she was Australian, or did she disguise that from them?
She disguised it very well. She never discussed it. She never talked about it at all. And I think you can feel it's an actressy British accent, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, I think, Edith Evans and, you know, some sort of British play of the 1930s, a slight Irish twinge as well, because she lived in Ireland for a while. But no one discussed it. No one talked about it at all. As far as I know, no one knew. Well, her friends must have known, but she didn't want
to know,
generally.
Valerie, my mother lived in Bowerock. I'm 8 years old, and one can sort of roughly work out when she was there. I have a vague recollection that she spoke about Mary Travers, and I think I'm about to make a fool of myself when I say that she I've got sort of wispy recollections that she lived with someone who wrote a show which was popular in England called Rookery Nook. Am I confusing her with somebody else? Because I suspect that I may be. Was there any man in her life towards the end?
No. I don't know about writing Rookery Nook. She wrote a lot, but she was in Barrow when she was between 8 and 18. Then she moved to Ashfield in Sydney, so I don't think she did. But now she's being celebrated there as an equal to Don Bradman. They have this huge kind of Mary Poppins celebration. It's nice. So Barrow's claim to
Barrow.
Famous Mary Barrow of Elderwell. Everyone wants a piece of it now.
Yep.
I don't know about writing this book.
But she had no man in her life.
Tell us about her fascination with Ireland. There's obviously influence from the Irish fairies, magic, Yeats, whatever, in Mary Poppins, but she obviously had she wanted to be thought of as having an Irish father. Where does it come from, and how did it influence her writing?
Her father told her, even though he was born in London, her father told her that he was actually Irish, and he read, Irish poetry to her when she was a child, and, novels and so on. So she fashioned her own poetry when she started writing poetry on the poetry of Yeats. To that extent, it really did influence her. When she met George William Russell, the editor of the Irish Statesman, he told her about, he believed in theosophy and the little people. He claimed to know he could see fairies walking on the beach. And so all of this influenced eventually Mary Poppins, because he said, why don't you write about, a magical fairy person, a witch even. And so Mary Poppins is actually like a good witch, a white witch, a black witch. So the Irish part of her is really strong, came from her father.
Well, it's interesting that Cameron McIntosh didn't know she was Australian, because I seem to recall from some of the reviews of your book in the overseas press, they thought that this was, one of the remarkable things about the book, this discovery for them.
I know. Well, he knew. So I may have made it a bit confusing there. He knows. In fact, he even wrote the last draft of the script himself, sitting looking at the Sydney Opera House, he claims. But he said to me that no one knows that she's Australian. Well, Cameron knows. He didn't really know when he began. He came back here. I believe he has a partner who's Australian, a photographer, and so he's been in Australia quite a lot. But still, you go to places, most people still don't know, have no idea. I don't even know who P.L. Travers is.
Yes.
Did
she keep contact with her siblings?
Not really. By the time she came back in the 60s, I mentioned one of her sisters was ill. She came back to see her. It was really sad, actually. I don't quite know what happened, but when the last sister died, she didn't leave anything for her. She didn't even mention Pamela in her will. Her sister's will. She just cut Australia away. And that makes her sort of a little bit unlovable now. You think, why? But as I said, that's part of the time, I think, the colonial times. But no, she didn't. There were two sisters, only one of whom married. They lived in Manly, but she didn't maintain contact.
It might be something in the barrel of water, because Don Bradman didn't go to either of his parents' funerals. He didn't go to his brother's wedding. Maybe it's barrel.
We don't want to go there.
No, I don't. Yes, John.
The major events during the life would have been like the First World War and the Second World War. Did that impact on her at all, or did she live in this sort of life was it encased in another reality?
Well, that's interesting. Actually, the First World War, she was really just a teenager and didn't have much effect on her, I don't think. But the Second World War, huge effect on her. She just adopted this child, this boy, and with him and some other children from England, they were evacuated from England and they went to America. She was a kind of guardian angel that took them all the way to Canada and the States. And she spent the war, as many British people, she wasn't British, but many people did, in the United States. She didn't come back until after the war. She went to New York and in Boston, and then she went to New Mexico, and she finally came back when the war was all over. So, she got out with a kind of good purpose, being a hero of all these evacuated children from Sussex.
Janet.
I was interested that you said she wasn't a big, like, J.K. Rowling. Of course not. But she was successful enough that the money she made from those books was what gave her a living. Is that right?
Yes.
Or did she make a living some other way?
No, that's all she needed. And she wrote other books. It was not the only... Mary Poppins was not her only book, but the other books are the late others, children's and adults' books. They were completely unknown, unsuccessful.
Oh.
Never made any money.
And what do you think of them reading them today?
Well, it's a very, very kind of dated. There are some things that have still resonate. And some, one of them is that she was quite sinister, Mary Poppins. I mean, she used to fly up to the skies, and one adventure she had, she was kissed by the sun, she said. Mm. So she came back, she had a scorching over the lips of the sun. And this is nothing like the Julie Andrews movie, you know. There's still things that resonate with children, and I think they, when mummy and daddy are not being very nice, you know, to you one night. You wish you had a Mary Poppins. You wish you had someone to take you on an adventure like that. And I think that's why it's got to last you a life. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot that's dated.
But this must be a period of history. Nanny McPhee's got the similar sort of thing, where children are kind of neglected by very well-off parents. And then in comes a rather bossy nanny and gives them all the fun that they could possibly want. It's strange that there is that contrast, that the children are actually made happier by someone who's rather bossy and scary, when their parents are sort of have given up on trying to look after them.
Well, any psychiatrist will tell you that children need boundaries. You know? Mm. And, I mean, Nanny gives them boundaries. And
Nanny McPhee is also quite...
absolutely Mary Poppins. Mm.
Quite ugly. Mm.
You said that you... you felt sorry for her, but did you like her?
I liked her at times. In the beginning, I was just completely neutral, like just looking at her like a specimen, you know, and then you start to fall in love with the subject, you start to love them, you have to. And in the end, I could see the lovable part of Pamela and the unlovable part. There's many unlovable parts. She was a woman that was a lovely, bright and happy young woman. You know, she did things that I loved her because I was a dancer and an actor and a journalist too, and I identified. But as she got older, she got more and more pompous, more and more self-important. Mm-hmm. And that part, I don't know. But I could see why she did it, the deep sadness in
it. Did anyone much like her?
I said, well, in the beginning, she had lots of people that liked her, friends, her lovers, and so on. As she got older, she got the love and support from that group of people that followed in her own way, in her dear way.
Did she have many lovers?
Well, she definitely had... I think she had George William Russell once. Mm. Frances McNamara, her son told me it was a deep love affair, serious. And there were these two women that the diary tells me that she was... They were lovers, but there's no absolute proof. She certainly wrote very erotic poetry, which still exists and we've been reading. Mm. It was in the Bulletin and the Triad magazine, but maybe that was just the yearning of the young man.
When you were writing it, was it the sort of book that you actually got into and had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and sort of write, or was it the sort of book that you just pushed out day after day, that some of it was wonderful and some of it was a bit arduous? Or did you just go and do the whole thing?
It wasn't one of those 3 o'clock in the morning things, although I thought about it at 3 o'clock. I had a very kind of rigid, you know, work day. I was very much helped by my husband and my children, and I took time off from being a journalist, so I get up and I just made it like a working day. I'd sit down, you know, at 10 o'clock or something and write, and then I used to come down and read bits to the family. But no, it wasn't one of those things. Another book I wrote, which is The Allen's Affair, about a disaster in a law firm that almost went bankrupt, that was like 3 in the morning, and I was ringing people around the world going, so what did he do then? And it was a real, you know, it's a fraud case, and it was very much a thrill, you know.
I missed anyone? Just as a final question, what now with the musical? I mean, do you, we still, I mean, as you said, Mary Poppins is a huge brand name, but Travis is still virtually unknown. I mean, I can't remember do you think that's ever going to change? I mean, your book has helped a bit, but you'd really need a film you'd need a film on Travers, wouldn't you, too?
Well, I think that's going to happen. The woman, the producer, I can't remember her name now, she produced Elizabeth I, she is a co-producer of a planned movie of Travers' life, but they won't do the whole life. They're going to take a bit, I think, about her relationship to her father and then her relationship with Walt Disney. It's a matter of getting the director and the funding. If that happens, she will be very well known, like Jane Barry, Kenneth, what's his name? Wind in the Willows. Bruce Beresford's making a movie of him. Bruce Beresford's making a picture, a film about him. So that's the only thing that can bring her to a big audience.
But there hasn't been any, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but there hasn't been a major documentary on her.
There have been two. There have been one. There was one made here in 2002, which was played on SBS and ABC, maybe replayed this month because of the musical. And there was one made by the South Bank Show in London in 2004, which I participated in. So, yes, but they've been played a bit.
Well, what are they like? Well, the second one's obviously quite good. You're in it, but...
I was in both, actually. Right.
So how do you find them?
I think the second one was really good. They had a lot of the musical in it, and they had a lot of her friends, and it seemed to be more complete. It was more fun. The first one has got imagined scenes of Pamela and the suicide, attempted suicide of her mother, and all that sort of melodramatic. But they're both worthwhile.
Right, but this has been a long-term project of yours, obviously.
Yes.
So how long?
Well, I first heard about her in 1986, but I didn't start researching until 1996, 10 years later. It took me 3 years to write. It was published first in 1999, then it was published in Britain in 2005, again in America, and then just republished. So I seem to be living with Pamela forever. It's like my grandmother or my mother.
We're getting close now, but have you found a need to revise much? I mean, have you got much new information in this new version?
Not so much new information, but new ideas. I mean, especially about her leaving Australia, and just like Louise Mack in the early 20th century, always was Australian women searching for a home, searching for something else, but not much revision. No. Thank goodness.
Okay, so many thanks. Take a seat. Lawson was last year, she's talking about the legal firm, and there are a lot of eager lawyers in the audience checking out what was going on. And today, people, I guess, are interested in Mary Poppins and Australian literature and Australian history. But it's a great story, and I'm very pleased that Barbara Lawson could find time to come here and talk to us about the new edition, Mary Poppins, she wrote. This is in Jennifer Grundy's got copies. Without doubt, she's a very important figure in Australian literature, even if she wanted to think she wasn't really Australian. She came from here and was a very important figure. So the talk will be on the podcast tomorrow or thereabouts. Anne will publish the paper in Sydney Papers, in Paper Channel 648 here tonight. So it's been a great night. Valerie Lawson, many thanks and well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.